This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by the wonderful patrons of Trek FM who support us through Patreon. If you love Star Trek discussion, visit patreon.com/trekfm to find out how you can help and even become a part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And we thank everyone for their support.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Continuing Mission, our look at the ways in which fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Dennis Castello, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series, or independent productions, that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. Back in Continuing Mission episode number 28, Brandon Shaymatala and I interviewed Tommy Kraft about the fan film he was working on called Star Trek Horizon. At that time, Star Trek Horizon was just about to premiere on the internet, and Tommy wanted to get the word out about the movie. After 3 years of working on the film, one got the sense that Tommy was exhausted and was probably a little worried that no one would watch his movie, or if they did, that they wouldn't like it. Well, he shouldn't have worried. Star Trek Horizon has been a huge success. As I record this now, it's been about a month and a half since the film went public on YouTube, and the movie already has nearly 1 million hits and a 95% approval rating. After watching the film myself, I was stunned by how good it was, and I knew that I had to have Tommy back on the show. So in this episode, I'm very pleased to be joined by Tommy, as well as two of his actors, Paul Lang, who plays Captain Harrison Hawk, and Ryan Weber, who plays Commander Francis Brooks. In this episode, we're going to put on our serious film geek hats and get into real detail about directing, acting, and all the various elements of filmmaking that went into Star Trek Horizon. And we'll talk a little bit about the response the film has received since its premiere. This interview is going to contain spoilers for the film, which is currently available on YouTube. We're going to discuss scenes and events in the movie with the assumption that everyone taking part in the conversation, and that includes those of you in the listening audience, have seen the movie. So if you haven't seen the film yet, I urge you to put this podcast on hold and go watch it. Then come back and listen to the interview. Oh, and make sure you keep listening all the way to the end because Tommy has a special announcement to make. And if you like Star Trek Horizon, you won't want to miss what he has to say. So let's take the turbo lift to the briefing room and begin our discussion with Tommy, Paul, and Ryan. Hello, Tommy. It's great to have you here on Continuing Mission for another conversation. And Paul and Ryan, it's great to have you on Continuing Mission for the first time.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Since we have Paul and Ryan here for the first time, let's begin with them. Guys, give us a sense of where you were in your lives before you even heard of Star Trek Horizon. Is acting your day job? If not, what is? Were you Star Trek fans before Horizon? And if so, what was your first Trek? Paul, let's start with you.
Okay, well, before I met, I actually met Tommy on a different production, one that was being filmed by Commander Jackson in the film, and Tommy was behind the camera. So I was an actor in the Detroit metropolitan area, and I've been acting for years. And, you know, when I met Tommy, he told me that he was doing a feature film with a lot of CG and no money. So, you know, I immediately was excited about that and thought he was a little crazy.
You thought right, I am crazy.
But after seeing his work, I hopped on and, you know, the rest is history. So now I'm in California and still acting and having fun with it.
So were you a Star Trek fan before the project?
Yeah, I was a Star Trek fan before the project, but definitely the original series in Next Gen. I kind of fell off after that. Life got in the way. I've got life, kids, a little bit like that. So I didn't get into Deep Space Nine or even Enterprise for that matter. I did try to catch up a little when we started talking about it but there's a lot of catching up to do. I am nowhere, just so I want to put a disclaimer, I'm nowhere near the Trekkie that either Tommy or Ryan are. Those two are like encyclopedias. You could see it on set. They would go off on tangents about, and they know the episode and the players. It was amazing. So I learned a lot from them.
That's a great segue. Ryan, what about you?
Yeah, I'd primarily been a filmmaker myself for many years. Acting is a second love for me. So primarily, actually, how I found this gig was I was casting. I have a web series, and I was casting for that. And I happened to be on the Michigan Film Office site and saw a posting for Star Trek Horizon. And to be honest, at first I was a little mad. I started my film career in 1999, and I did my own fan film series. We did four movies, and I thought, the ironic part was there's another fan film in Michigan. I said, this is kind of neat. So I contacted Tommy, and we hit it off pretty good, and he was gracious enough to let me into the cast, and I had a lot of fun with it. So that's kind of how I got involved, and obviously because of that, you can see that I've had a bit of a background in Star Trek. It's been a favorite of mine for a lot of years. Next Gen's probably my favorite, along with Deep Space Nine.
Cool, cool. So let's bring Tommy into this. So Tommy, you have this film that you want to make and you need actors. Tell me about the decision to go with trained actors instead of, say, casting yourself and your fellow fans, as a lot of fan projects do. And how you went about casting, not just Paul and Ryan, but the rest of the cast as well.
Well, because for me, the first and most important thing was always that I wanted to make a good movie. That's always been my thing. I'm a filmmaker first and also a Star Trek fan. I always wanted to find good actors. It wasn't about finding the biggest Star Trek fan. And so that's why, you know, I contacted people I knew I could trust, or I did the casting calls and I auditioned people. And so, yeah, that's always what it was for me. And it was the same with the rest of the cast. They were either people I knew and had worked with on other film projects, or were mutual acquaintances, or they were people I found via casting calls.
So, Ryan, Paul, jump in here. What did you think when you were first approached to work in a Star Trek fan film? What was your reaction to the casting process?
Tommy, I think you approached me.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that he was doing the Horizon film at the time, but I knew Tommy. And so he, like I said, he called me up and said, you know, I'm doing a Star Trek, and which is, you know, immediately interesting. But I really did ask those questions, like, you know, I mean, of course, I've been in a lot of independent films, and, you know, some of them, if you've been involved with them, you know, they can just go on forever. And so I asked him, you know, how long is the film? Is there any, you know, computer graphics? And, you know, what kind of budget are you looking at? And when he got to that last question, I was like, oh, okay. You know, but we knew, you know, I mean, I knew Tommy not as well as I do now, of course. And, you know, we had a mutual acquaintance, and I'd seen him on set on Extended Slate, which was the short film that we worked on together before that. And, you know, you can't help but like Tommy when you meet him. So, you know, I signed on. It wasn't a hard decision. He sent me the script, great script, you know, ambitious as all get out. Did I think he was going to finish it? You know, at first, did I think he was going to finish it? I'll say it was probably a 20% chance. And then that percentage grew quickly, though, when you see the dedication that Tommy had. You know, you knew that he was going to finish this film. You know, he's single-minded and very dedicated to it.
What about you, Ryan? You said you saw a casting notice.
Yeah, I saw a casting notice. That's how I first hooked up with him. And he made me do the, you know, typical read-through. I think we did something through the internet, so I read a bunch of lines, which ultimately I think was the scene where I'm telling Paul about the my dead girlfriend. So I read that scene, and you'll have to ask Tommy what he thought of it, but I guess I got the job.
Yeah, we definitely want to talk about that scene a little bit later. So, Tommy, tell me about creating the casting notice and the casting process of meeting the actors and such. Now, I went to film school, so I know that for myself and my fellow students, now, whether we came into the program with a lot of filmmaking experience or whether we'd never picked up a camera before, the one thing that we all had in common was that what terrified us most, I think, was actors. I know that for me, the scariest thing was putting out a casting notice, asking actors to come in and audition. And then after you find an actor you really like, one that you think has real talent, you have to ask them to work in your film for no money. That's one of the hardest things to do as a budding filmmaker or director. At least it was for me. Tommy, how did you approach that?
I would agree. Hardest conversation to have. I hate it. And I hate working with actors for that reason. Not to say I actually hate working with them, but I hate like getting them on board. It's the worst. It's because I can do so much of the other stuff myself. I write, I direct, cinematography, all that crap. But, you know, the acting is like you have to rely on other people. So it's something where you're really putting yourself out there. And especially for somebody like me, who's kind of an introvert, it's even harder to call up people and to, you know, and to do all this stuff. But it's just one of those things you just do. I messaged Paul and I think I was pretty honest. I don't remember now anything I said. I was like, hey, I'm making a fan film. I want you on board if you're interested. And, you know, I mean, I was obviously hopefully a little more professional than that in my wording, but, it was the same with the casting calls too. Michigan Film Office.
Paul is shaking his head.
Yeah,
oh,
I see. No. he's so lying right now. But you know, it was just one of those things you just do. I just put out the casting call and I, you know, worded it however you word those things. And I emailed with people, and because everybody's like, I'm in the middle of everything. Ryan is 2 hours more or less to my west and Paul was 2 hours to my east. And so when I did some auditions, like I did with Ryan, we did it over the internet, as he mentioned. He'd sent me a video and I gave feedback and I liked it and he had the job. But it's just all about honesty, I think. You was one of the things I really hate is when people, because I've had people offer me visual effects jobs and deferred payment, which of course means you're not getting paid, or like we'll pay you after the Kickstarter, which means you're not getting paid. So I just think for me, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, if I did do this, but I don't think that I like promised things that wouldn't come. And for me, that was the biggest thing. Just be honest about what you're doing.
Well, Paul never got the trailer that he was after, and I think that he was really upset about that.
Yeah.
Well, and there was this other guy I worked with on a short film who never got donuts, and he still gives me grief to this day. He wanted donuts on set. And I did. Paul can tell you this. To our first reading, Ryan wasn't there because I don't think I'd cast him yet. Actually, I hadn't. It's a fun story. We went out to this guy's house that Paul knows. He's an actor in the Michigan area. And he had let us use the location for our reading. And I brought donuts. And that was the first time we'd ever worked together. I wound up not casting that guy. And it was kind of awkward after that. But and the most awkward part of that reading, too, was when I accidentally laughed at him. Because this is not to make fun of him at all. But he has a really high pitch voice, okay? And we were reading the scene and his line was "Captain," like exclamatory "Captain." And so just he read this line like 2 or 3 times, and like I swear to God, it got more Mickey Mouse each time in terms of like the pitch of his voice. And eventually I just laughed and I blamed it on Mark. I was like, "Oh, I was looking at Mark. I laughed at Mark." I don't know if he bought it or not, but we didn't do any more readings at that place after the fact. After that.
He just promised to feed us, and we got all the pizza we could handle. It was good pizza.
Well, yeah, that was. Where was that from again? It was the same place.
That's right.
I'm trying to remember.
And Paul even paid for the pizza one day.
Yeah. Good pizza is essential. It's absolutely essential.
Yeah, it was Marino's. It was just down the street from my house. I go there at least once a week still, too. So you were getting the best.
Anything that's not just Subway sandwiches. I mean, nothing against Subway. But it just seems like every day it's Subway sandwiches on some of these low-budget shoots.
Well, you know, and if Mark is listening to this, when he did Extended Slate, the short film that I met Paul on, he bought us all lunch, but he bought us, like, vegetarian Jimmy John's.
Yeah.
And the thing is with Jimmy John's, it's really plain and bland anyway. It's like a sandwich you can make at home. So it was like bread with cheese on it or something. So you guys got pizza from me. I was not getting you vegetarian Jimmy John's.
No corners.
Yeah, no corners caught on my production.
He's got no budget, but he's got standards.
That's right.
Nice. Okay. So the film is cast and Paul and Ryan are chosen. Now the script goes out. So what did you guys think when you read the script? What kind of discussions did you have with the director about your characters?
Well, Tommy asked a lot of questions. I remember, Tommy, didn't you, like, you asked us some questions regarding backstory and, you know, try to build the character somewhat. When I first saw the script, my impression was it was ambitious. It was, you know, you're reading a script that, I think it was 300 pages, your first script?
Oh, not even close. It was 136.
Oh,
it felt if it'd like been 300, but yeah. Yeah.
And it was kind of like reading a book with a lot of words that you don't know in it. So I had to go and do a lot of Googling, like who the heck the Iconians were. And, you know, but, you know, I did think it was ambitious. And we did have some meetings and talking about, you know, some backstory and how we wanted to do the characters. But Ryan?
Most of that, I think, wasn't till on set, though, like, because at least the way I tend to work is like we only actually had one reading, like where we weren't shooting. And so like most of like backstory discussions would come in like the context of rehearsing a scene. And I would like try to give some sort of context as to why that particular character was making the choice they were making.
Yep.
I thought the script was absolutely brilliant on my first reading. It was incredible.
I had no idea Patrick Stewart loved my script so much.
Oh, you know, I thought it was excellent with tea and marmalade and everything. I first read the script. That was one of the things that really attracted me to the project, actually. You know, at first I was a little unsure of if I wanted to do it. And Tommy had sent me the script. And I actually have never really read a script the whole way through on a first read, but there's something about it just really intrigued me when I was first able to sit down with it, and I just crammed right through it, and I shared with him that I thought he had a really good movie here. And what really set it for me in my head, though, was I was able to catch one of Tommy's short films that he'd done prior to this. I forget the name, but there was a lot of visual effects in it, and I thought this kid actually has a chance to pull this off. I thought he really had what he needed, you know, just with his own skill set to really pull this off. Because you're reading this, it was like a typical Star Trek script. You know, there's effects everywhere, and knowing that it'll be all green screen, that's one of the things to consider too. How challenging that can be as an actor. You know, most of my scenes were just me alone. A couple times with some other actors, but you know, that's another challenge that's in of itself with it. So, but the script and story, I think, were really there. I was a big fan of Enterprise when it was on the air, so to kind of see the script tell that story and kind of wrap it up in some angles that they didn't do on the show was really interesting to me.
Okay, so the film is cast and Paul and Ryan are chosen. Now the script goes out. So what did you guys think when you read the script? What kind of discussions did you have with the director about your characters?
How much did I work with you guys on character, though? I don't remember us like having a lot of in-depth like character discussions, did we?
Me and you?
Well, any of us, because I think most of that came from the script, and it was just like in the context of rehearsal. Like, I didn't have to work with you guys. You guys pretty much just got it for the most part, I think, when it came to your characters.
I wouldn't have talked to you anyways.
Okay, let's talk about rehearsing. You touched on this a little bit with your previous answer, Tommy, but did you guys do a table read?
Yeah, no, we did one, and that was the one I mentioned where I accidentally laughed at the guy and felt like a douchebag. But
who was that guy going to be cast for, Tommy? I never heard that story.
Your role.
Oh! aren't you lucky that I came on?
There you go.
I am, because until you, I had no idea who I was going to cast. I was kind of a mad scramble. We only had the one table read, and it wasn't even the whole cast there for that read. It was just a small portion of the cast. And then after that, we just started shooting. We didn't read the whole script for that table read. We just kind of went through some, because it was really just for me to get an idea with the people I was working with, you know, what, you know, how they were feeling out the script.
Okay. It was 300 pages long. I don't think anyone can make it.
talk about ambitious.
Let's get into some specific scenes. Let's start with that first scene right after the prologue. It's an exciting battle sequence, and it kind of amuses me that the first time we get to see Captain Hawk, he's face down on the deck. So, Paul, Tommy, tell us about shooting that scene.
Well, the I mean, for my part, it was the same way I shoot everything else. Fun fact, it's the only scene in the only shot in the film that used a motion-tracked camera. The rest of the shots with the moving camera were done in post, but that shot I actually had a dolly in the room, and I did the camera movement manually on set. But, I mean, we had this physical chair platform that was built to the dimensions of the virtual bridge set that the captain could interact with, and we put his chair on. And it's kind of hard to see in the final, but, like, he has his hand on the lower part of the floor and pushes off, so you have that real set interaction. But beyond that, we had like our flickering lights and everything to simulate the fire, and it just all got comped in, and I had to make sure Paul got as close to Captain Commander Riker on his report, but didn't want it to be Riker, just saying. But, I was thinking of, Generations, of course, when the ship's going down and Riker's report, but no, it was a good delivery, and it was a good scene.
Yeah, it was, you know, like Ryan said, when you're sitting there and it's you, you know, basically, I think on that shoot, though, I think Janine may have been there. I don't think Tom was. And maybe Mark.
That was actually one of our biggest shooting days, I think, in terms of people that were there, because it was you, it was Tom.
Tom was there.
It was Janine. Yeah.
I think I was there too. That was during the costume.
Yeah. Because you can talk about that too, Ryan, the costume fiasco, because I had to make Ryan a second costume. because he crapped it. No, I'm kidding. But
you know, but like you said, when you're there and Tommy's describing a ship blowing up, you know, and you know, I'll basically, you know, just on his command, you lurch heavily to the right, you know, and throw yourself on there or get up and it's supposed to be all smoky. You have no idea, you know, no idea how it's going to come out. And as you can see, I mean, it came out brilliantly. I think that's more that Tommy had to change the effects to react to us rather than us reacting to, you know, a set. So, yeah, that part is challenging as an actor. It's a lot more... It's a lot easier to play a scene with another actor. There were scenes I played with Ryan, which I didn't make the movie, but I know I saw a cut of it. You know, we had a couple of that one good powerful scene where, you know, right after you know, spoiler, well, it's not even in the movie, but I tossed Tamara into the airlock. That and also, you know, whenever you see the scenes between me and Janine, we were there together. And that's why those scenes feel definitely more unique or more, I guess, authentic. You know, it is difficult. It is difficult to just sit in front of a green screen on a chair and say, okay, report, you know, my ship's on fire. You know, get her to sick bay now. You know, it's like you look down at the floor. And I know there's a couple times I looked the wrong way and we had to reshoot it because I was looking to the right and to the left and, you know.
Okay. So there were eyeline considerations. But, you know, every shoot has these eyeline considerations and every shoot goes through stuff like that. But most shoots have a scriptie or a script supervisor who keeps track of eyeline and other continuity issues like that. Did you have a scriptie on set, Tommy?
That would be me for the most part. And that was part of why it was like that particular shot we were just talking about with Hawk getting up off the floor. That one was particularly difficult because I was operating the camera. I was pulling focus, and I was moving the dolly myself, and I was trying to remember when to yell action and cut, and I also had to remember when to yell boom, because there's a big explosion that goes off right behind Hawk, and so when I'd yell boom, somebody would turn the lights up to make it look like there was an explosion, and that's when Paul would lurch himself out of the chair almost, and the thing with the eyeline, too, that I give... I can't believe it actually worked in the final with everybody, is that I think Ryan is the only other person who actually knows that bridge. Like, you know,
I remember arguing with you on the scene where I was at the tactical station arguing with you about where I was supposed to look. I said, no, you're wrong. I have to look right here. And I think I was ultimately right.
Well, aren't you always? But, I mean, that's the thing, though, when you think about it, because there's like four people that the captain especially has to keep in mind for where he's looking to. So, like, there'd be a lot of times where, you'd have to look to the comm officer, then to the helm, and then, you know, over to tactical. And it's a lot to keep straight if you're – you know, if you have nothing there to look at, because he didn't even have people there off camera most of the time to look at, to for his eye line to match up. Ryan never had that issue, of course. He's perfect. So.
Right. You know, this is why when someone asks me, what's the hardest job in filmmaking? Is it directing or editing or cinematography? I say the hardest job in filmmaking is acting. That's the most difficult job.
Yeah.
Because actors have to give a great performance that has people believing it's completely real and natural. But at the same time, the actor has to hit their mark. They have to keep their eye line straight. And the eye line is never like the true eye line. They often have to cheat it for the camera, because where the person is actually standing doesn't always look right on the camera. So to make it look like the actor is looking at the person they're supposed to be looking at, they actually have to look someplace else. And then, of course, they have to hit the light. And maybe they have to lean into an eye light to get that little sparkle or gleam in the eye that's, you know, so beautiful. And they can't allow any of those considerations to kind of cloud or pollute their performance. And also, the thing to remember with actors is that it's their face that's up there on the screen, and everyone is seeing that. And the majority of people can't help but associate the actor with the quality of the project, even all these things that are completely out of their control, like audio, right? So yeah, acting is the hardest job in filmmaking. And I wish I had come up with that. But actually, Stanley Kubrick said that to Charlie Rose. But I totally believe it.
Well, I agree. No, I'm kidding.
All right, so we've covered that first scene. So Ryan, tell us about the engine room fight scene. That was pretty awesome. Right off the bat, you've got Romulans beaming in, you've got a shootout going on, you've got to work the engine controls, and you got to do it all on this green screen set. So tell us what that was like.
You know, I don't remember any of it, and I'm not even joking. I honestly don't. Honestly, there were portions of that were filmed on a certain day, and then I remember we were at this big studio in Detroit, so it all was at a different time. At least for me on that one, that I just remember it being all over the place. But to me, it was always fun. One of the things watching other fan films that always bugged me is how the actors don't know how to use or you know what I mean? They don't know how to use the weapons. It doesn't look real. So I think that's the thing I was trying to keep in mind in that scene the most, was I want to make this look like a real firefight. Especially knowing Tommy's skill, I knew that we could pull that off pretty good. And I think actually when I first saw that, he sent me like a daily, you could call it, where there was the first effects that were in it. I was just geeked. I thought that was so cool to see that all come together. The way he was able to put all these elements in it is just, because I'm going to be completely honest with you, Dennis. If you watched this, if you watched Paul on the floor on a 7x5 foot green wall, looked like a comedy. But when you put this, when Tommy gets it all put together, right? I mean, it's great. I mean, literally, it'd be like me going, you know, it just didn't make sense as if you watched us actually filming it versus what actually ends up on screen. So it's really good to see. It's not just a combination of the acting, but all of those visual effect elements are so huge to make this all work together.
That's why one of the things I would like to release at some point is like a scene deconstruction with just one scene where it plays the scene finalized and then without any effects or sound or anything. But one of the things that we did on that shoot in Detroit that Ryan mentioned was a guy that Paul knows, Scott Sprague, who owns a studio out there, let us shoot there for free. He had a gray wall that he uses for his photography, and Paul went and repainted it green. Scott let us repaint that thing. The reason I needed that was because I had this huge, for two reasons. A, it was close to most of the actors, so they could come by easily. And B, I had this huge platform that my brother built to the dimensions of the platform in engineering in front of the warp core. And so Ryan came out the second day we were in Detroit, which was a pretty long drive for him, I think. And so he interacted with that big platform and climbing up it and all that stuff.
And
which
it
is
wasn't
how
the most stable. It was all no. Over it, the place. I had to yes. make it work.
Yeah. Well, luckily he brought his friend Jack, Jack covered up with a big green cloth, and he held it steady for us while Ryan climbed up it. But it was kind of terrifying. But it looks cool in the original because then he actually gets to interact with the set.
Cool. That's very cool. That helps sell the whole engine room scene, really.
There were, by the way, behind the scenes knowledge, all of that Detroit scene, I think I did show up on the second day to that one, but when I got there, I have never seen somebody more sick in my life
yes.
than when I said hi to Tommy. I mean, I don't even know how you were directing the film at that point. You looked like you had the flu or something, but it was pretty nuts.
Yeah, I was like, my nose would not stop dripping. It was alternating periods of so stuffed up I couldn't breathe or dripping so much, like I was constantly, like, had to have a cloth underneath me or like a rug underneath my feet or something. And it's actually funny when I go back and watch the takes, and I hear myself like directing or calling action, like my voice sounds like a couple registers deeper, on that day. It was murderous.
Okay. We've talked about the first couple of scenes. So now let's take a step back and address the look of the film, because it's been getting a lot of comments. Tommy, you created a look for this film that incorporates shallow depth of field, composition of flat space, and this kind of high contrast, highly saturated color grading. It's probably the most strikingly cinematic look that I've ever seen in a fan film. So tell me about how and why you developed that look. We'll get into camera stuff like lens flare and camera movement next, but tell me how you came up with that look.
Well, the simple reason is it's the most flattering on Paul's skin tone, so that's what I did.
It's all Paul's fault then.
Yep. But in all seriousness, Ryan too. That's the real reason, his skin tone. But no, so I like shallow depth of field. So that's one reason I went with that choice. That's the main reason. And one of my biggest pet peeves, you see this all the time in sci-fi TV shows, in low-budget movies, when they do their green screen compositing, they either have zero depth of field on their background or very little. And so it gives it this really fake feel where you know it's a composite because there's just nothing in the background. And then so the whole like foggy blurry look of it was I just wanted a diffused look because it helps cover up the edges of the green screen more, and I kind of like the look. It's a very similar version to what you see. Like, I always go back to this example because it's popular on NCIS. They shoot like all their shows with a diffusion filter in front of their lens, which gives you kind of a foggy, hazy look to your image. And so that's essentially what I was doing here, except I was doing it in post. And it really just helps blend your composited edges together a bit more, especially where, like in my case, where as I went along, I learned about green screen and how best to do it. And so my earlier stuff honestly wasn't lit as well. And so it was harder to pull a good key on that footage. So it was in some cases the lesser of two evils. And, you know, if I did a second horizon, I would use the same look but less. So, yeah, there's that.
Well, cool. Okay, now let's move on to the camera. You've got this camera style that, to me, kind of feels like J.J. Abrams does Battlestar Galactica, you know? It's got lens flare, it's got shaky cam, it's cool. So tell me about that and about your camera movement in general. How did you accomplish that?
Well, Ryan can attest to this. I asked him early on what he thinks about shaky cam, and he was all against it. Unless he doesn't remember that conversation, which is entirely possible. But I used a slightly shaky camera throughout because, for me, it helps sell, again, the compositing aspect of it. Because one thing you always see on lower-end green screen stuff is the camera is completely still and locked off the entire time. So for me, it was a creative choice to always give that feeling of movement to kind of help people not, you know, the thing that they say is you need to have at least three elements in everything that you do so that people can immediately deconstruct it. And so that was my thing. I added some camera shake, lens flares were another thing, the whole foggy look thing. It was all these different things working together to help try and combat the green screen feel of it. And also, I'm just a huge JJ fan. And honestly, since before I even knew who JJ was, I had an obsession with lens flares.
Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah.
He just made it worse.
All right, let's go back to the scenes for a bit. There's this great scene after the battle in the corridor where Brooks is talking with Hawk and saying that he wants to throw Tamar out the airlock or something like that. So tell me about that scene.
I'm trying to gather my thoughts on that. So can you mention it again real quick? I'm sorry.
Sure. That's where you're wondering if it was all worth it in reference to Tamar. And I think the opinion is put forth that things might be better served if she was ejected out the airlock or something. And Captain Hawk did not react too well to that.
There's two corridor scenes. So there's the first one where Ryan makes the mention about throwing her out the airlock, and that's right after the opening battle. And then there's the other one where he has the conversation with Captain Hawk about his dead girlfriend.
Yeah, that's what I call the transporter repair scene. We'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
But I wanted to go over this first corridor scene because it's the first inkling we get that Captain Hawk is not necessarily happy with the effect that the war has had on them.
Yeah, I guess from a character standpoint, it was. There's also a lot of removed elements from the final film that were in the script. That was kind of a prelude scene too. But without getting into that, I think, you know, you've got this engineer guy who, you know, the Romulans are a people that just shouldn't be trusted in his standpoint. And here the captain brings on this genetically altered, appearance altered individual. And, you know, she's just an observer. She's working with the crew. And I think he had a real problem with that. And that's what he was trying to get out. He wanted to make sure that the captain was doing the best thing he could do for the ship and crew.
And in my standpoint, I mean, obviously the captain doesn't want his chief engineer tossing the Romulan that he fought so hard to get for the last 6 months out the airlock and totally hosed the whole operation because he's angry. And you know, not to mention she's awful cute.
That's the real reason.
Yeah, that's the real reason. The neat thing about that scene is that shot, we were both walking individually. So Tommy had to put two different shots together side by side because we only had one treadmill. Yeah. And the treadmill, what was the name of the treadmill? Was it Star Trek?
It was a Star Trek.
Trek treadmill. And so, you know, we'd have to walk one at a time. And the other person would stand, you know, to the right or to the left, whatever it may be, and deliver the lines.
Oh, and that was impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, Tommy might remember how many takes there are, but I just remember having a lot of fun with that.
Yes. And it was impossible for a couple of reasons, too, because one, you had to match up the timing between the two. But also at the end of that scene, they stop walking and because they come to the turbo lift. And so also, fun fact, Callie, Tamar, was operating the treadmill controls. And so she would push the stop button and sometimes it wouldn't stop right away. And so they'd get to the end of the scene and they'd stop talking and stop walking, but they'd keep moving forward because the treadmill just kept rolling them forward. So we had to do a ton of different takes until all the timing just got matched up perfectly. And also, one other fun fact about that scene, Ryan did a lot of rotoscoping on that one for me because the green screen wasn't quite big enough. Because it was one of those little portable ones that I'd hung up behind the treadmill. And so Ryan went in there and rotoscoped, I think, that entire scene of them walking. And so mad thanks to him, because I didn't have to do that, thankfully.
Wow. Well, you'd never know it to watch that scene.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I think it ends up working really well. What I like about it, as I said, is that what it reveals about Captain Hawk, that he's desperately trying to hold on to the ideals of Starfleet,
right,
despite being in the middle of a war.
Well, that was one of the big things that I talked to Paul about while we were shooting, is that I wanted Hawk to be very much, you know, he's learned from his past mistakes. And we learned in the film that he doesn't say it directly, but that he found the people who killed his boomer fiance and he killed them, and so he learned from that,
right,
and he wants to help Francis from going down that dark path.
Well, let's jump to that scene since we keep referring to it. It's a great moment, and it really plays to Brooks and his character arc and elaborates on this past event of Captain Hawks that he first brings up in the lake house scene.
One of the things as a writer that's really important to me is parallels. And so Hawk lost his fiance 20 years ago when her cargo ship was raided. And now Brooks has lost his fiance in the Romulan War. And so I wanted Hawk to have that connection with him where he's experienced it.
My fiance!
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I don't know what impression that was, but I enjoyed it. So they both have lost fiancés.
We're lady killers, what can we say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the nice thing about that scene, yeah, it was the writing. And I think that is one of the scenes that they quote, at least in comments, you know, who we are, what we are. You know, we should never forget that. And I think that really plays to, you know, the traditional Star Trek. And, you know, kind of like the ideals of it, you know, what the Federation stands for. And so the character, you know, Hawk's character sees, I guess, in Ryan's character, a parallel and doesn't want him, you know, to go off because, you know, he's realized that revenge doesn't necessarily heal, you know, those wounds. And, it was a powerful scene. And luckily it was a scene that we could do together, you know, obviously, because those powerful scenes, you know, it's tough when you don't have, you know, someone there, you know, playing opposite. But in that case, we were able to do that scene together, and I think it shows.
Well, cool. Yeah. That's kind of a natural segue.
Well, I have to say one other thing about that scene of how sore Paul's butt got, because because they're sitting, if you guys remember, they're sitting up on the transporter pad.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like doing all this makeshift stuff to get a step that was the right height for them to sit on. So I found this cardboard box. But the problem is, after sitting on it for about two or three takes, it caved in. So then I found a 2x4 or something like that and stuck it up in the box. And Paul was essentially sitting on, you know, the 2x4. And it was like, you know, like driving into him.
It helped with the
pain. it made it a method scene. And Ryan had to sit on a toolbox, a plastic toolbox that would like creak and everything whichever way he moved. So it was a real makeshift
funny
thing, but it worked out in the thing. I mean, I guess like maybe if Paul had even been able to work tears out of that pain, it would have been something else. But
yeah. I have butt marks to prove it.
Yeah.
Permanent butt marks.
Right.
This is what happens when you work on a movie with me.
Yeah.
Right. Permanent butt marks.
Well,
you know, where no 2x4 has been before.
Hey, that rhymes.
So let's talk about one of my favorite scenes now, which is the lake house scene. I remember watching this for the first time and thinking, wow, these guys are really nailing it. Because that scene came out really well.
Well, thank you.
There's this great moment on the balcony after we've been watching like 20 minutes of flat compositional space. And then there's this cut to Captain Hawk standing on the balcony and looking out over this lake and its deep space and deep focus. It's a very powerful transition. And it leads to a really powerful scene. And I have to say, Tommy, that I find it kind of ironic that in the midst of this science fiction epic filled with all these fantastic special effects, I think some of your best writing and your best performances take place in this everyday setting at this lake house. So tell me about that scene.
Well, I mean, just from my perspective, what really interests me in any movie are the characters. I think that's what makes any movie interesting and worth watching. So this scene was just my way of approaching these characters and how they're dealing with this situation. And with Captain Hawk, I wanted him to be war weary and experiencing this loss of Amelia, which I think set him apart from other captains because it's his character flaw. You know, he has this problem. And I wanted to also have a scene where the characters could connect, you know, having never met these characters before. And also just, you know, about the production of it, that was Janine's house. Janine plays Amelia. And she let us shoot there. It was a great location.
Yeah, and it was a good scene. You know, I got a chance to play with Mark, play off of Mark, and you know, it's good, powerful writing. And as an actor, you know, you get a chance to, you know, kind of show vulnerability and gain that emphatic response, or at least try to gain that emphatic response from the audience and let them know that you're in pain, so that way they feel for you. And I think it was, you know, successful in that standpoint. That you know, you see a person who's, yeah, he's a Starfleet officer, but he's just a guy like anybody else. And now his, you know, latest girlfriend flew out an airlock. He's just got no luck with chicks, and so, you know, he starts resorting to drinking. And if you notice, I'm the only one with whiskey, and I don't know anyone picked that up, but
that is a choice that we made too when we were shooting.
Yep. Yeah.
Don't you, I think I had whiskey as well. I think the real story is, what was I doing on the ship? You know what
yes.
I mean?
Mendez. We're hanging with Mendez.
That's right.
Well, you know, and I will say that originally in the script, after that scene on the porch with Paul and Mark, or with Hawk and Jackson, then it cuts back to the ship and Ryan, Commander Brooks. That's when he kind of goes off the bricks, or off the bricks, off the wall. I don't know what I'm trying to say. He does something. That's when he throws Tamar in an airlock and starts to open up the airlock and basically torture her because he wants to.
You gotta put these scenes online just for fun, even if they're not completed. I think it would just be fun, you know, deleted scene type material.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it was a good scene, too. But the movie was just kind of too slow with it in there.
It's right. You know, but actually, it's funny. And this is when actors experience this a lot. Some of our favorite scenes that we enjoy often do get removed from movies or things like that. But my favorite scene, I guess, that I recall from the film was with Paul and the Admiral in the Admiral's office. I just thought it had a real good feel to it, and I think Paul and I hit our mark pretty good with it from what I remember. But I remember really enjoying that scene. I think I get the bus down kind of a,
like, if you guys want to talk about, I mean, it's not my podcast, if you want to talk about it, you can, but I mean, I really like that scene because the gist of the scene was, after Francis throws Tamar in the airlock, he gets in trouble for it. And so Paul has to come down in the middle of the night to the Admiral's office and give you know, Francis a stern dressing down for his actions. And they knocked it out of the park because Hawk was so irate and Francis was like trying to do anything he could to like justify his actions. They did a really good job, and it was just too bad the scene had to go.
Oh, so why did you remove it?
Well, because the problem is, without him throwing Tamar in the airlock, which I cut, it wouldn't make any sense to have that scene in there. And I cut that because the movie was getting too slow in that middle portion with all that extra stuff in there, and it didn't really add that much, because we know that Francis is kind of bigoted and that he has issues with Tamar, and it almost, I think it was too much. It was kind of like it went too far over the edge with him throwing her in the airlock, and it's just unfortunate, because there was also a scene with Callie that Paul and Callie had when she's in the med bay recovering, and they were really good in that scene too. But of course, that had to be cut because, you know, the airlock scene got cut.
Oh, okay.
And thanks to that scene getting cut, we never learn who the doctor is. I don't know.
We never even see them. We even know there's a sick bay. Marie. Who knows what happened to Marie?
Yes. This is why we need a sequel, so we can go to sick bay.
So I'd like to talk about something a little more general. And this is mostly a Paul question, but there's some Tommy stuff here too. Now, something that I always admired about Leonard Nimoy is how seriously he took the role of Mr. Spock. Back when nobody knew anything about what Star Trek could be, and at a time when space stories were kind of considered kids' stuff, Nimoy could have hammed up the Mr. Spock role, you know, the way Jonathan Harris did with the Dr. Smith role in Lost in Space. But instead, Nimoy took the role seriously, and he crafted this truly unique character. So, Paul, in your case, you were called in to play a character in a Star Trek fan film with no budget, shot in a guy's basement, And I don't think anybody would have blamed you if you kind of treated it as a lark. But instead, you took the role very seriously, and you created the character of Captain Harrison Hawke with a performance that really grounds the film, I think. And for my money, the Captain Hawke that you created stands up equally well with the Kirk and Archer, or Sisko, or any of the other great captains on Star Trek. And let me just say that I haven't been affected that way personally by other fan productions. And I just want you to expand a little bit on how you approach the portrayal of this character.
Well, wow. Thanks for that, by the way. That's very nice. And, you know, I think a stretch. No, I'm kidding. But,
Well, Paul, I'll just say, if you don't want to take credit for it, I will. It was all my direction.
Yeah, it was Tommy's direction. Well, actually, Captain Hawke, with the difference, I think, and it's come up in conversation, as you can see on some of the comments, you know, in YouTube, is that Captain Hawke is not necessarily the typical Star Trek captain in the sense that he's a veteran warrior. It says so, you know, in his character description on the website. And I think we did have a little discussion regarding that. I spent some time in the military, and so I based it off of, you know, what you would expect from, you know, a naval officer who is running a ship. And whereas, you know, I guess I wasn't as swarthy as, you know, like Captain Kirk, I didn't have that kind of, like, you know, machismo going on. I'm not as swarthy as he is anyways. But, you know, I wanted to play it kind of true to form of a pseudo-military officer trying to hold a ship together during, you know, a very intense and tense events. And so, and then just downplay it. Try not to go so over the top and so character-y, and make it more so, you know, a guy who is just basically trying to do what's right by Starfleet and trying to get this mission control, you know, under control and get it through without, you know, adding too much cheese to it. And so, you know, it was definitely, Tommy can take a lot of that credit because, you know, he kept it. That was his direction, you know, for the most part, you know, keep the character real, keep him a real person in real events. And he's got a job to do. And one thing that, the one aspect of the script that I don't know if it came through though is he's definitely tired because he never really gets a full night's rest in the whole script. So, you know, he's a working guy, you know, he's trying to get it through. He's trying to keep working. And I mean, you know, keeps getting deployed, keeps getting woken up in the middle of the night by everybody and their mother and his, you know, his temporal girlfriend. And you know, so, yeah, I think, you know, what we tried to do is just create a real guy, you know, a true officer. And I saw a couple comments from people, especially if they were in the military, they could see that, you know, just trying to keep the chain of command going, trying to keep everybody doing their job and not let things fall apart.
Well, I think you accomplished that well. Go on, Tommy.
One thing I'll say in regards to that, too, is that from a directorial standpoint, I try not to tell people when they're doing a good job for the most part. And that's because one thing I noticed is that when I did another project, other projects in general, when I've commented on actors doing specific things and pointed it out to them, like, hey, I really like that, they will occasionally start overdoing it. And so I never mentioned this on set, but like I never specifically told Paul to like play it like a military guy, but I got that sense that came through to me from a directorial standpoint, and I really liked it, and it was a choice that I thought fit the character a lot. And you know, I think it worked in the performance too.
Well, great. Let's talk a little bit about that. What do you do when you're not getting stuff out of Paul that you want? I mean, what do you do? Do you bribe him with ice cream? Do you hit him with a shoe? I mean, how do you give him adjustments? Let's open it up to anyone. How do you give your actors adjustments to help shape their performances?
Well, first of all, I start with that 2x4 and I say, do you remember what this felt like? But, you know, it's really just, and I'd be interested to hear Paul and Ryan's opinion on this and what it was like working with me. But generally, you know, when we're going over a scene and rehearsing it, I'll just I'll just talk about, you know, the character, motivations, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what kind of choices they're making at any particular moment, and what kind of choices I think they should be making. And I try not to be tyrannical. And again, you guys can tell me if I was, if I'm completely wrong in that. But like, I like to work with the actors and just work through the scene until we get something we're both happy with. And it's usually just talking about whatever's going on the page and trying to work it out.
I'll speak to that. For me, Tommy gave me a wide berth to be able to do kind of my interpretation of this guy. And I think there's a lot of, for an actor, there's a lot of positivity in that you can kind of craft the character to the way, you know, you were reading him at first. You know, and there are certain points that, you know, Tommy wanted a delivery different and he'd let you know and he'd read it back to you. And then you'd have to kind of translate Tommy's delivery to, you know, the English language.
Did I give you a lot of line readings? I hope I didn't.
No.
Oh, good.
But that was what I thought was really great about the production is I could really kind of come at it with Tommy's help, but come at it from an angle of where I saw the character.
Yeah, I agree. I you know, one thing about Tommy was is he would give you, you know, comments here and there, but like Ryan said, wide berth. And I don't ever remember seeing Tommy ever get really angry, you know, even when things weren't going his way. With the exception of our makeup artist, Vera. And so...
which, by the way, was the day I was really sick, too, which I think probably played a part in that.
Yes, that was that day. You know, he let us play. You know, he let us do what we do, and you know, for the most part. And, you know, he would steer it at the beginning, and, you know, hopefully he got what he wanted.
All right, so what about those scenes where Brooks is in command? He's in the center seat. I bet that was fun. Tell me about that.
I know Ryan had a lot of fun with that.
It was, for me, it was great. You know, Paul's character certainly farted in that chair a lot. So it was a big seat to fill in that regard. No, a lot of fun for me. I did four movies as a captain myself in a fan film. So it kind of came naturally, at least the language and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, just having more intricate knowledge, probably safe to say among the cast, the biggest Star Trek fan is right here.
He's pointing to himself.
Right. But for me, it was pretty natural. I didn't have to think about that too much in terms of it. I know personally myself, just as a geek, I was looking forward to that. So,
well, and he made some fun choices in there too, like the scene that takes place in the whatchamacallit, that room behind the bridge, not the briefing
room, conference room. Yeah.
And Ryan's pacing back and forth. This is the scene directly after Paul confronts Daikon for the first time, or I should say Hawk confronts Daikon. And Ryan's pacing back and forth, and that was a specific character choice, if I recall right, that he wanted to do. And I liked it. It worked for the character. And I think he changed the dialogue at the end of that scene, too, where he just says, "Let's do it." I don't remember what it originally was, or if he just wanted to play Captain Janeway with the "do it." But it wound up working really well, and it fit the character of Francis a lot.
Well, cool.
Yeah, some of the best moments, if I can remember, is... throughout the years, you know, even on the original series and Enterprise and stuff, when the chief engineer gets to take over the ship, something really bad has happened.
Yeah, by the time they're down to the engineering command, yes, you know it's serious.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the reception the film's been getting. Has it surprised you?
Yes. Yeah, surprised me. I didn't even think people would watch it, to be completely honest, and let alone like it as much as they seem to have.
There were times when I would read so much negativity that I remember coaching Tommy prior to the film release, at least, you know, with my fan film experiences, there's just so much, it's the internet and it's full of negative people. Yeah. And I remember telling Tommy, just don't be shocked if you know, it's always true in any entertainment form that the vocal minority are the ones that hate something. And oftentimes you don't hear the positive things. So for me, it's been really great to read all of the positive things. It really kind of changed my perspective on that.
Well, I'll say that I told my wife that when we were getting close to getting it finished and I'd seen parts of it, I said, you know, I had seen a lot of fan films out there, and, you know, everyone has. And knowing Tommy's work, I'm like, I think this will stand as, if not the best fan film out there, you know, bar none. And it was just, you know, it's due to the dedication, you know, the quality of the cast, the dedication of Tommy and just the amount of effort that went into make really a true production. I mean, there, and it's said in a lot of the comments, this could be, you know, on a television, and, you know, it's only a couple years removed from the big screen, if that, you know. You know, granted, you know, with what he did, the budget, you know, it's amazing. But even if you knew none of that and you just saw it one day, and there's people out there who comment that they kind of tripped along, you know, and found this movie on IMDb. They're not Trekkies, and they watched it. And when they come to the realization of how it was made, you know, they're shocked. But regardless of that, it's just a good quality movie. And, you know, it's so I'm glad, though, that the people are appreciative and they are showing that appreciation rather than, you know, those typical, you know, YouTubers who will, you know, tell you, and they're out there still. We still get a couple of good comments like, well, how many bald guys can you fit on a ship? And, you know, and did they lose all fitness requirements in Starfleet, you know, and it's things like that that really make me smile. And so the hard part's not responding to them and, you know, starting an internet yelling match.
Well, and it is fun to do that, though.
Yeah,
it is.
It is.
You
know,
Paul, you might appreciate this. I work at a large credit union in Michigan and in the marketing department. And there's this whole base, we call it the basement full of IT guys. Right. And so just this past week, I got a instant message from one of my coworkers and said, I don't know. Are you in a Star Trek movie? And I said, why? And literally I walked downstairs and there's this room full of programming nerds and it's on all of their screens. And they just like standing ovation to.
Oh, how awesome is that?
But it was so weird. It's not like they found it on their own, you know, and that was what was really cool about that. And a lot of compliments to you as well. I heard from just people that it's like a real Star Trek movie, you know?
Yeah. And that's, I think that's kudos to Tommy. You made an actual film and, you know,
thank you.
There's not many people in this planet who can say, yeah, I made a film and I made a real film. I mean, it's not that there's fan films out there that aren't real, but, you know, some fan films are great with one aspect and other aspects are a little light on. And this is a complete package. And, you know, it's a testimony to everybody involved, but especially to Tommy and his dedication to it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And that's a great place to end it right there. So thank you guys.
Thank you. I enjoyed it once again.
So, Tommy, why don't you tell us where people can find Star Trek Horizon? Hopefully they've seen it before listening to this podcast, but just in case they haven't, let them know where they can find it.
Yeah, it's StarTrekHorizon.com, or go to YouTube and search for Star Trek Horizon, or go to Facebook.com/STHorizon, or just search for the fan page on there, Star Trek Horizon. Basically, like, anywhere you go, like, even if anybody still uses search.com, you know, search for Star Trek Horizon, and you'll find it. It's all there. It's up there on YouTube, and like the official website redirects to the YouTube when you watch it. So yeah, it's real easy to find for anybody who's interested.
Okay, well, Tommy Kraft, Paul Lang, and Ryan Weber, thank you so much for coming on Continuing Mission and talking with me about Star Trek Horizon.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know that sounded like the end of the interview, but the episode isn't over quite yet. Just as I was putting the finishing touches on this episode and getting it ready to go up onto the Trek FM network, Tommy Kraft contacted me. It seems he has an announcement that he wants to make. So rather than make everyone wait another week to hear what Tommy has to say, I thought we should just add it to this episode. So we're going to hear Tommy's announcement and then chat with him and Ryan Weber about it. So, Tommy and Ryan, long time no see. It's been a couple of weeks since we last talked, although for our listeners, it's only been like 30 seconds. But welcome back.
Thank you for having us, and I'm glad to be part of this temporal vortex that the listeners are experiencing, where it was slow as weeks for us, but seconds for them. There must be a black hole nearby or something.
Yeah, something is warping space and time.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Dennis.
Hey, my pleasure. I love talking with you guys about your projects. So, speaking of projects, Tommy, don't keep us in suspense any longer. What's this big announcement?
Well,
This is like deja vu right now, because didn't we just do this like a few days ago where you guys had an announcement you wanted to make and you called me at the last minute and then we decided to get together and tack it on the episode? It's just this weird thing where I'm feeling this weird deja vu. Somebody is rewriting the Matrix.
Well, that's definitely me. There's a black cat somewhere around the corner here. The wall has just changed to a solid brick wall. But we're back. It's nice to be back. Thank you.
There's been a lot of interesting stuff happening. Tommy, do you want to give us kind of a rundown of the events, starting with your initial announcement and then this kind of like latest breaking news?
Yeah, well, so the basic gist of it is we came back on Continuing Mission after our last show where I said I'm absolutely not doing a sequel. And we recorded an episode with you that you were going to attach to the end of that episode where I changed my mind. I'd been convinced to do a sequel. Ryan and I had been co-writing and co-producing the sequel together. We were really excited about it. We announced that we were going to launch a Kickstarter campaign on April 23rd. And on Wednesday of this week, I got a call from CBS, and they told me that I should not proceed.
Wow. They lowered the legal boom on you guys, eh?
They did, unfortunately.
So what do you think about that, Tommy? I mean, are you devastated? Are you relieved? Are you angry? Yeah. Are you just, I don't know. Tell me what's going through your mind.
Well, you know, Ryan and I are both upset because we had a really good story that we were really excited about telling. This is one of the big reasons I got excited about doing a sequel again after I was so dispassionate, because we were really interested in the story that we had. And I have to imagine this is a lot how it feels like for a TV producer or writer when their show gets canceled. You just feel like you have so many good stories that you're not able to tell now. And but that being said, I also did feel a huge bit of relief when I got that call, only because we were always concerned about legality, Ryan and I were. We were always concerned that given the current climate with Axanar, that we would get a call. And so my relief came from the fact that I got a call before we ever started raising money. And I was able to heed their advice without being in a position where I had $250,000 in my pocket and where I would have to give that back or do something with it where I was not able to then make a movie. So there was a lot of relief from that regard. But it's definitely kind of a 50-50 thing for me.
Right, right. Well, I can certainly understand that. And I have to say, after hearing what you and Ryan, your ideas that you had come up with for your sequel, which was going to be called Star Trek Federation Rising, boy, I was really excited for that film. It sounded like you guys had a really great idea.
Thank you.
So I'm very disappointed that we're not going to get to see that. And I think that as somebody who supports all kinds of fan projects, I would like to see all fans be able to do their fan projects. I'm of the opinion that all fan projects help their brands, whether it's a superhero fan project or a Doctor Who or Star Wars or Star Trek. They all help their brands. The nobody goes to see a fan film instead of a commercial blockbuster film. They'll go to see, they'll definitely, if they're a fan, see the blockbuster. That's a given. They're the most relied upon audience for that blockbuster. But since they're big fans, they're also going to see the fan film. It doesn't take, in my opinion, it doesn't take anything away from any kind of commercial product. Sadly, a lot of corporate entities don't feel that way. So what are you going to do with your idea now, the Star Trek Federation Rising sequel idea? Or are you just going to mothball it, or do you have any plans?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, CBS's discussion with Tommy was quite clear, and that I think what we understand is that they won't support, or they highly encouraged us not to make a sequel. And with the story, you know, in terms of filmmaking is what Tommy and I are, filmmakers. So I don't see a real need to do much with that. Last night, right before we made the announcement, we were discussing, should we at least release what we have? And I just feel like it just isn't going to do any good. You know, we have to take what's happened and move on from that and try to make good of the situation. And, I think we're very humbled by what our initial reaction from our announcement, from our fans on the Facebook page. We're very happy with how many people have showed their support for us. But also, you have to take a look at, CBS too. I think, and I don't want to be sipping the CBS Kool-Aid, but I'm kind of gracious that they did come out the way that they did with us, especially right before the fundraising, the Kickstarter campaign Saturday. I mean, if we had started getting into all that and then this came later, I think it would have been a lot messier. So in terms of having, the story, it's a big bummer that we can't tell it, but I think in a setting kind of like this, Dennis, we'd be happy to talk about what we were thinking for the story, but I don't think it really serves a whole lot of purpose to keep dwelling into that and get involved with that.
I can certainly understand that, absolutely. So I am curious about something that maybe I can convince you to talk about, and that is that you've mentioned a couple of places now on your Facebook page and in some of your other social media that you have another idea, a non-Star Trek science fiction concept that you might move ahead with in place of Star Trek Federation Rising. Can you speak to that at all?
Yes, absolutely we can. The project is called Project Discovery. And it's inspired...
Project Discovery.
It is. It's inspired by the name of the space shuttle, actually. And so the basis for... As was the name of the NX-04 in the Star Trek movie. But the basis of the story is that it's the 2060s. And around the world, people have generally lost interest in going to space. There's kind of this negativity around things. People aren't happy in general. And so our crew of characters starts a crowdfunding campaign to get people all over the world interested and passionate once again about space travel. And they crowdfund the objective to build a warp-capable or FTL-capable ship that they can take out and explore. And so over the course of this campaign and all that, they are able to basically unite people all over the planet, get them passionate, and have a very multicultural team of people that works on this project to go to the stars and explore a new world, basically. And so it's a very, it's our own unique concept, but Ryan and I, being such huge Star Trek fans our whole life, are very... The ideals that Gene Roddenberry started out with in the original series are very resonant with us. This idea of people working together, this idea of all of humanity coming together for a common cause is very important to us. And so our story is centered around this. And it's centered around this mission of this group of people that goes out there. The first ones kind of like, Neil Armstrong on the moon. The first ones out there beyond our solar system exploring and the adventures that they come across during that process.
Yeah, the major elements of story that I think are heavily focused on are overcoming challenges. That's one of the biggest takeaways I've always had from Star Trek is a group of people getting together, overcoming a big challenge. And I think, getting together as a team and figuring out how to fix problems and better humanity is ultimately what our new story will help focus on.
And the thing is, Star Trek was, it's been so important, I know, at least in my life. Like, Enterprise literally helped change my life in a lot of ways a few years ago. It inspired change in me. And so that is something that's part of my DNA now, you know, and every story I tell going forward is going to be inspired by that in some way. And this story is a manifestation of that as well. And it's something that we've been co-developing alongside of the Federation Rising thing, because as filmmakers and as storytellers, we always knew that we wouldn't be making fan films forever. And, you know, for me, always my goal has been to become a quote-unquote professional writer-director. And when I started Horizon, it was, for me, it was a huge learning experience, and it seemed like the next best step to take on me learning how to become a good filmmaker. And after I finished Horizon, I had to find out what the next best step for that would be. And eventually we came upon this doing a sequel idea, which seemed like a great idea. But I also knew that after that sequel, I would have to find something else to do. So I was always planning on and working on other projects in the meantime. And even during Horizon, I developed at least a number of ideas. I know I have at least one finished feature script that's been through like 6 or 7 drafts. That's not a sci-fi, but you know, it's something I did during Horizon. So I'm always developing and always writing, same for Ryan. And so in this process, we also are planning for the future. And that's why we started this project as well.
Oh, interesting. Are you still planning to shoot this in Los Angeles?
We are, actually. So basically, because a lot of the thing for me with doing a Horizon sequel was that I wanted to do something that was more than what I did last time. And that's been my philosophy with every movie I've ever made. Whatever thing I did in my last movie, I would not only do that again, but I would add something new to it. And so, go ahead, Ryan.
No, I was just going to... I'll add after.
Okay.
You had a good personal moment that I interrupted with a
Way to go. Way to go. But no, so it's my whole process has been to add something to whatever I did last and move forward. Horizon was a huge addition, and part of the reason I didn't want to do a sequel was because doing it here in Michigan in my parents' basement, there was no value to me in doing that in terms of like I wouldn't learn anything from doing that again because I've already learned everything I could from doing that. So when I hit upon this idea of moving out to LA and meeting LA people and working with people in the area, making contacts, and actually for the first time in my life as a filmmaker, managing a team of people, that was exciting to me because it's something I haven't done before and it's something I need to learn how to do. So I still need to do that. And that's the plan with Project Discovery.
Yeah, and full disclosure, this project that Tommy and I are working on certainly has been there, but it certainly wasn't the forefront. I mean, we were putting most of our energy into Federation Rising. But the good news is we had a lot of plans in place already for Federation Rising. So what we're able to do is transition a lot of that directly into this. So we're taking the energy that we had from Federation Rising and putting it directly into this new Project Discovery. And I think it's important to note that we don't want to look at the bad. You know, a lot of people would be bummed or just hurt by, you know, having to shut down something like that. But we really want to take the positive out of it and really encourage folks that had supported Tommy, you know, on the first movie, became fans of his work. I really want to encourage those people to help up, you know, stand up, support us on this new movie, and we would really appreciate and welcome, you know, anybody, you know, and if for some reason any other fan production ends up getting a similar fate, I would love to talk to them, reach out to them, and maybe we can combine efforts in some ways. Maybe there's some resources shared that we could utilize because there's a lot of creative people out there. And, you know, Tommy deals with a lot of those other guys a little more closely than me, but, you know, I think it's something that we think about, something we talk about a lot. So, you know, in terms of plans, we will continue, the same energy, the same, you know, I want to call it like the same epic proportion because we were really, one of the things with Federation Rising is we wanted to be 9 times bigger than Horizon. And I think for Tommy and myself to come off the heels of doing Star Trek Horizon, we still want to be 9 times bigger than what we did. We want to really show people that we're great filmmakers. So that's really what we're trying to do.
I can understand that. I can certainly understand that. So it sounds like your film is going to be set in close to present day. Did you say 2060?
I did. That's around the area it's being set in. And part of the reason for that is we want to have a certain relatability to what's going on today. I mean, you think about, and this is a huge part of it, and it's been something that's really fascinated me as I study these issues. It's, you know, you look at NASA, and it gets, I don't remember the exact, like 1/10 or 1/14 or something like that of every penny on the dollar in funding, while we are concurrently dropping so many bombs in the Middle East that we are literally running out of bombs.
Well, not only that, but those private companies are, you know, like SpaceX, they're having a lot more energy in space travel than what has traditionally been a government-funded operation. So that's kind of where our story leaps from, is from that idea that, you know, the great moon race of the 1960s obviously has expired. You know, with the expiration of the shuttle program, there's really not a big drive to get out into space. Mars certainly has its perks, but you know, the thought of manned space travel is really dying rapidly today. So I think for humanity's sake, in terms of space exploration, there's always that desire to go out there. So that's really what we're trying to do.
And a lot of it too, I think, comes from, you know, back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, it really was a space race with the Russians. We had to beat them to space, and it became a symbol of national pride for the United States to say that we were going to be the first ones to the moon, because the Russians were first with Sputnik. So we had to beat them in the next venture. And then once we did that, and then when the Cold War ended, people just kind of said, well, what, you know, what are we there? What's the point in continuing if we don't, if this isn't attached to our symbol of national pride? And so our story, you know, it takes place where it's taking that to the next level, where we don't put any money basically into NASA and space exploration. We have all this thing where we're putting money into wars and into other things that we, you know, where we could at least spend some money in trying to further the human condition. And this story is about getting back to that place, and also getting there because it's not about a symbol of national pride, but because it's a symbol, but because it's, we're passionate about it as a people to go, to take, it's to take ourselves to the next level.
And there's other ideas that work into that. You know, you have Professor Stephen Hawking, who said that should humanity wish to continue, that it needs to leave Earth in essence. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that we have to work with in our sandbox. So we're quite happy with this story. I think, you know, in terms of where it can go, it certainly has a lot of legs.
And I think anybody who's a fan of Star Trek and a fan of space exploration will be able to get something out of this story, because that's what I am and that's what Ryan is. You know, we love this stuff. And our influences, we always wear them on our sleeves. At least I know for a fact that I do. And, you know, it's the kind of story that I think we need, especially in a time where sci-fi is so commonly dark sci-fi. You know, everything's gritty and dirty and grungy. And we want to do something different. You know, we want to kind of bring back that feeling of optimism that we can do things positively.
So how does the faster than light work into it? Because that's pretty science fiction-y concept.
Well, it's not really. I mean, the only reason we can't do it now is because we don't have a way, or at least we don't know how to manipulate the exotic matter required to warp space. But the math is very sound. It's been done many times. And it's been reworked to the point now, whereas previously you'd need an energy mass equivalent to Jupiter to create a warp bubble, and now it's gotten down to the size of, you know, like a small spacecraft. And
we'll have a very technobabble explanation for that. You know, there'll be a flux capacitor.
So you're referring to the NASA. Recently, NASA published some kind of like artistic images with kind of like a donut-shaped ring that lowered the amount of energy that was needed.
But it's not just technobabble either. It's not, because that's actually real science. That's real math. And that's what I think is cool about it, and what excites me, is that you know, if we can just find, I really feel like in like my lifetime, we could make the breakthrough of how to create a stable warp bubble. We know mathematically how it's done. We know what needs to be done. We just don't know how to get there. And that is literally the only way that we know of to cross vast distances in space.
Right, without altering, you know, your physical location via wormhole. That, you know, space
right.
travel
That's
itself,
the other one.
You know, when you get really into space travel, it's a very difficult concept because, you know, as you get further and further away from Earth, it's all about space-time at that point. So
right.
It becomes very unrealistic to travel through space. So you have to figure out, you know, like the warp bubble, you know, and developing all that will be necessary, you know, if in our story to do things like that.
And I just want to say, I think one of the coolest things when you think about warp drive is that if you were to actually have a warp bubble, which, by the way, doesn't move the ship, it moves space around the ship, which is how you are able to go faster than light because space can expand faster than light and contract faster than light. If you were to look at that ship as it's coming toward you, it would actually look like it's going in reverse, mm-hmm. which is really nuts, but it's also really cool. This is like the science stuff that excites me. Mm-hmm. And it's because the light that of the ship closer to you is going to reach you before the light of the ship farther away from you because it's moving faster than light. It's really neat stuff. So, but the point is, like, you can tell that I'm passionate about this and Ryan's passionate about this. And so it's not just about technobabble. It's about, like, having a realistic, like, an actually possible way to include faster-than-light travel in our story. And that's part of the optimism of it, too. Because it's about how could we, like, on paper, maybe actually do this.
So do you have any characters yet?
Yeah, we do have characters, actually. And what we're going to do, I don't know how interesting it would be to, like, I mean, like, yeah, we've got, you know, this guy and his name is Billy Bob. And you know, like it wouldn't mean anything to anyone. But over the next few weeks, we're going to really start getting into casting and getting people attached. And then we're going to start making announcements once we have people attached so you can actually visualize, you know, who this character is and what their significance is.
And I suppose that you haven't started writing a script yet because you've just now decided to do this.
Well, I mean, no, we're getting started, yeah. But because, like I said, it's something that it's been on the back burner, and the only difference is now we've taken Federation Rising off the stove, and we've moved Project Discovery to the front burner. And, you know, as I said, like, during Horizon, I wrote, like, at least 10 shorts and at least one... I wrote one feature film during Horizon and at least 10 shorts. So, like, I'm always developing and thinking about stuff. And so now I'm just bringing this other project to the forefront and really kicking it into full gear.
Yeah, I mean, Tommy and I had pretty much fully developed the story for... Federation Rising within a week. I mean, that's how rapid we were able to get that stuff off the ground. So, you know, this is a good concept because we've been working with it for a while. We've talked about it extensively, and we're really excited. You know, once we get a little closer to dive really into all the specifics of it and make it. So I think that's going to be really cool. And I really hope that the people that followed us with Horizon will continue to follow us with this new project.
Absolutely.
Well, it sounds really, really cool.
Thank you. So we don't want to lose our momentum here. You know, a thing with me especially is I like to always keep moving. This is why when I'm working on one movie, I'm in the process of making another movie as well and developing it. So what that means is the Kickstarter for Project Discovery is live right now. It's Friday night / Saturday morning. We've just put it up. You can check it out at Kickstarter.com. Just search for Project Discovery. You can go to ProjectDiscoveryMovie.com or the Horizon Facebook page. And we will, in the next couple of days, also be putting up a Project Discovery Facebook page. So please, if you get a chance, check it out and share it.
Well, Tommy, Ryan, thanks very much for coming on and talking about this. It's disappointing to hear that your sequel won't go forward, but I'm very excited to hear about your alternate project, and I'm looking forward to Project Discovery and hearing more about it.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
This isn't the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Women at Warp.
The only way that she can get through the trauma is remembering what her real story is, and that's getting this puppy home and taking care of it.
I wish that Captain Jeremy Nelson said, let's get this puppy home.
Melodic Treks.
You know what lesson I got from this?
What?
Don't rely on technology to solve all of your problems.
What does that mean?
It means don't play on your iPad all the time.
That's what my teacher told me.
Your teacher's very smart.
Saturday Morning Trek.
Dorothy had a little bit of a fit with the animators. They had said over and over again, there is no moon in the Vulcan sky.
I think it was like the first episode that aired of the original series when they mentioned this, because Uhura walks up to Spock and she's like, tell me I'm beautiful. Tell me that I would look good in your moon. And he's like, Vulcan has no moon. I'm not surprised.
Continuing mission.
So why don't you give me a little bit of a thumbnail of what Starship Grissom is?
First, it's a Star Trek fan film. It's written by teachers and designed so teachers and educators can download it and use it in their classrooms.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or if you have a fan project that you would like to discuss with us, you can contact us in several different ways. You can use the form at trekfm/contact. You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the Continuing Mission show page at trekfm, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. Our Twitter handle is @TrekFM. We can be found on Facebook at TrekFM. Or you can join the discussion on TrekFM's listeners-only group on Facebook called The Babel Conference. Type The Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at TrekFM and click Discussion on the menu bar. The Babel Conference is a closed group, but if you ask to join, we'll let you right in and you can join the discussion. We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of Continuing Mission on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and any suggestions you might have for the show. If you want to get in touch with me, my Twitter handle is @DennisCastello, and I can always be found on our listeners group, The Babel Conference, on Facebook. We'd like to acknowledge the rest of the Trek FM team, without which this or any of our other podcasts would not be possible. See Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM. Our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, Trek FM's art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. Thanks for joining us, and see you on the next mission.